This is Jacinta Parsons on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
One of our very favourite historians, Dr. Eve Rees, who joins us every, well, it's a month now, isn't it, to share in the stories of the people and the places that we darn should remember but have often fallen by the wayside. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jacinta. It's great to be back.
So good to you're actually in my eye line, which is just a joy. So you do have a very important role for us this afternoon.
Well, I'm here to tell you that the first woman elected to Victorian Parliament was Lady Millie Peacock in 1933. And Lady Peacock came into Parliament in slightly kind of interesting circumstances. What had actually happened was that her husband was Sir Alexander Peacock, who was a three-time Premier of Victoria and had, you know, been a Member of Parliament for 44 years. So he was sort of a bit of a living legend. And he died while still in office. So Millie Peacock was kind of urged to replace him in the by-election that was called after his death.
Who did the urging?
Well, so Sir Alexander was a member of the United Australia Party, which was a sort of the party of the Prime Minister, Joe Lyons and Robert Menzies. It was sort of a precursor to today's Liberal Party. So kind of Liberal Party stalwarts thought that, you know, this kind of giant of Australian politics had died. They needed a replacement and the wife was the obvious choice.
That's not, though, very obvious back in those days that a woman and a wife would take on such a prestigious pathway.
Not at all. I mean, you know, this Millie's political milestone had been an incredibly long time coming. You know, Australian white women first won the vote federally in 1902, but not until 1908 in Victoria, making us the last state. And even then, they weren't allowed to stand for Parliament. That wasn't allowed till 1924. Again, Victoria was the last in the country. And even then, no women were getting elected. You know, five women stood in the first 10 or so years, and none of them had any success. So, you know, this was history-making to suggest that the wife of a politician should be the one to replace him rather than, you know, another male politician. And it's also very telling about the gender dynamics of Parliament at the time and, you know, arguably since in a way, that the first women to, you know, have these, you know, important roles in our public life, they weren't necessarily the kind of fiery, feminist, politically progressive trailblazers we might assume they were, because those women were sort of a bit too much to handle. You know, if the sort of the thinking at the time, you know, really was that if you're going to have a woman at all, which was, you know, as I've been saying, a bit controversial, you know, it needed to be a safe woman, you know, a conservative woman, a woman married to a politician, a woman who was a kind of establishment figure who seemed palatable.
What did she do once she got there?
Well, she had a kind of interesting political career because when the campaign was going on, she didn't make any public speeches because she was still in mourning for her husband. And then when she got into Parliament, surprise, surprise, there was a lot of press attention about her appearance and what she was wearing. You know, there was a big controversy.
Something's never changed.
I know. You know, we've still got, you know, debate about, you know, Hillary Clinton's pantsuits. Well, back in 1933, the big question was, you know, would Millie Peacock wear a hat or not in Parliament? Because, of course, this was a time when, you know, respectable women wore hats in public, but there was a rule in Parliament that you weren't allowed to wear a hat, because this rule was developed at the time when it was assumed all parliamentarians would be men. So this was a big debate which occupied a lot of airtime. But, you know, Millie Peacock, she did really occupy the accepted role for women in public life at the time of the kind of the mother to the state of Victoria, or, you know, a mother to the public realm. So she kind of talked about herself as a politician who would help further the interests of women and children. She kind of wasn't interested in taking on issues that were seen as kind of men's roles, but really styled herself as a kind of, you know, feminized, respectable, maternal politician who was concerned with social services.
Which sounds like actually well needed in an environment that wasn't necessarily understanding or supporting those voices.
Completely. I mean, this is sort of one of the tensions of, you know, women and feminism in Australia at the time, that, you know, they did need women concerned with women's issues in public life, but the pressure to kind of confine themselves to women's issues was also a barrier, because then, as today still, women's issues were seen as marginal, as trivial, as not very serious. So it was a kind of limit to how far you could go in public life if you were seen as kind of a woman concerned with women's issues.